I'll invite you to turn to Luke chapter 1 with me. And I sure hope the microphone wasn't on when I was singing. Was it?
We'll let it slide.
Thank you. Thank you. Luke chapter 1, 1 through 4. I remember it was a couple years ago, my wife and I were listening to Ravi Zacharias. Not actually him, but one of his disciples, I guess, if you will. He's in charge of the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries of Europe. His name is Michael Ramsden. And he was addressing his audience, and at one point he said, he asked the audience, "Why are you a Christian?" And he said, "I'm not asking you how you became one." He said, that's a different question. I'm asking you why you remain one. Why do you still believe? Why do you, with all the options today, why are you still a Christian? And as a Bible teacher in high school, I thought, oh, I want to ask my high school kids that. But before I could ask them, I had to answer it myself. So, Rick, why are you a Christian? Why do you remain a Christian? And that got me thinking and studying and led to this sermon and a few other sermons, actually, why I trust the Gospels. First of all, before I read the passage, I simply want to say I think I do what you do, and we do it probably unthinkingly, and that is we tend to give the author the benefit of the doubt. We assume that they're telling us what they believe to be the truth until we have reason to suspect them, until there's maybe some internal inconsistencies in their writing, or there's external inconsistencies. Otherwise, we give them the benefit of the doubt. So as I read, keep that in mind, and let's hear again what kind of testimony Luke asserts He is providing for us. Luke 1, 1 to 4. "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." Would you join me in prayer? Father, I pray that you would strengthen for the believers here, most of us, I pray that you would strengthen our confidence in you and in your word. But Lord, if there are any here that are not sure, they're seeking, they may be even still a bit skeptical, I pray that you give them reason to believe this morning. Give them something to think about. Gird our faith. Convince us of how reasonable it is. And this I pray in Christ's name. Amen. So once again, I choose to believe Luke and Matthew, Mark, and John until I can no longer. I choose to take him at his word until I am forced not to. Consider the things that he said in his introduction. He said he looked into this history, having followed all things closely for some time past. He's done his homework. He's investigated. This is not a mere kind of a surface look at this material. He did his homework. He interviewed a lot of people. He thought about reporting it, his information, his findings, in a way that made sense to us. by writing an orderly account. He's trying to help us believe. He's taking into consideration firsthand eyewitnesses we see in verse 2. He himself was not there for most of this. He was there for some of the stuff that he tells us about in his sequel in the book of Acts, but not for the stuff found in the Gospel of Luke. So he does the next best thing for us. He seeks out and finds and interviews those who were there. Why? That you may have certainty. He believes he's gathered enough information, enough reliable testimony to get us beyond reasonable doubt. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the evangelists, provide us with the most comprehensive biographical information we have on the historical character of Jesus of Nazareth. And I have five reasons that strengthen their credibility in my eyes, and I'm only going to share the first three with you this morning in hopes that you'll want me to come back to finish my sermon. But here are the first three reasons that I grow. The more I think about this, the more I look for evidence in the Gospels for these three points, the stronger my faith grows in all of this. The first is because of their continual appeal to actual historical persons, places, and events. Their continual appeal to it all. Secondly, their divergent or differing accounts of the same event. Sometimes people take that as contradiction. I don't think we need to. They're divergent accounts of the same event. And thirdly, their inclusion of counterproductive material. Why say these things? Why include these things if it seems to not help their message go forward, makes their leader or themselves look weaker? Why include that stuff? So here's the first, and I'm going to spend more time on the first point than I will the second and the third. So if I think that's a good heads up for you, so you don't panic and go, Rick, you're going to miss your flight again. So number one, their continual appeal to actual historical persons, places, and events. When you start looking for all of this, as I did with Highlighter, I was amazed at how much you're going to find in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If you happen to still have your finger in Luke chapter 1, you might not even have to flip page, just look to the other side to see Luke chapter 2, verses 1 and 4. I think that's a great next illustration of Luke's continual appeal to actual historical persons, places, and events. Listen to all of this. First four verses of Luke 2. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem. That's rich. That's a rich four verses there. Notice how Luke locates the birth of Christ in geographical space and historical time. These are reported as actual events. There really was a registration, and not the second registration, but the first. And these are actual places. There is a Syria, a Galilee, a Judea, Nazareth and Bethlehem. And these are real people. Caesar Augustus, Quirinius, and Joseph. And by locating the birth of Christ in, and not just the birth of Christ, but his, his life, his ministry, and his death and resurrection, locating them all in geographical space and historical time. Luke is inviting further inquiry, as if to say, I know you're going to find some things recorded here hard to believe. I know. We don't see miracles all the time. So I get it. I just want you to know, I welcome your inquiry. Investigate. See where I'm wrong. Check it out for yourself. This stuff can be verified or falsified. We can put it to the test. When the Gospels were written, a number of first-hand eyewitnesses were still living. And from time to time, some of their names are appealed to. There's some name-dropping that goes on in the Gospels. Take, for example, this from Mark chapter 15, verse 21. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. Names of the people whom Jesus interacted with or healed are not always mentioned, as you well know, not by name. So we get descriptions like a rich young ruler, or a woman who had this kind of illness for X number of years, or a man born blind or a leper. But when we're given names, that was the evangelist's way of saying, if you don't believe me, if you want this to be verified, go ask Alexander or Rufus about their father Simon carrying the Lord's cross. They're still here. Go talk to them. Or if you don't believe that Bartimaeus was born blind, go ask his father Timaeus. Still here. Still part of the church, Jericho. Go ahead. Or go ask Simon the leper who lives in Bethany. Bethany, as you know, is just a stone's throw away from Jerusalem. Go to that small village, small enough. Ask for Simon, who once was a leper and now is healed. That doesn't fit too many people's description there in that small town. Or I love this one as well in Luke chapter 8, verse 3, when Luke is providing us with a list of the women who came along and helped the Lord and supported and provided for the Lord's work. In it, we get this curious little phrase. Luke 8, verse 3. And among those women were Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager. Go and ask them. By locating the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth in geographical space and historical time, the gospel writers invite further inquiry. I love what Luke records for us in Peter's Pentecost sermon in Acts chapter 2. He says, Jesus of, this again, of course, this big crowd, many of them from out of town, but still a number from town, Jerusalem, Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. I love that. In your midst, as you yourselves know. This stuff took place. He's appealing to common knowledge that can be verified even by those disinclined to believe. I want to close this first point with a quote from C.S. Lewis, where he says, I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they are like. This is my life's work. I've loved it before it became my life's work. And now it's my life's work. I'm very familiar with all of these genres. I know none of them are like this. Of this gospel text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, or else some unknown ancient writer without known predecessors or successors suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative, what we might call today historical fiction. I understand him to be saying, no one reported history using that kind of genre before the Gospels come on the scene. And no one used it after until the mid-1700s. It's much more likely this is actual reportage that took place in geographical space and historical time. Let's also keep in mind that when Lewis was doing most of his studying and preparing in specializing in these poems and romances, etc., he was an atheist. So he had his reasons for not wanting this stuff to be true. But the evidence, his commitment to follow the evidence where it led, led him to believe this is historical reportage. And so that's the first reason that I have confidence, and my confidence continues to grow in the Gospels, their continual appeal to actual historical persons, places, and events. And the second one is their divergent accounts of the same event. Their divergent accounts of the same event strongly suggests their lack of conclusion and their willingness to stand by their own testimony. If we were to set the four accounts of the feeding of the 5,000 next to each other, we would find just what we see. That while they may differ in some small details, they agree on most everything. I tried to make this illustration come home to my Bible students in teaching the Gospels to them. I chose four students to work independently from one another and said, I want you to write a brief paragraph, descriptive paragraph, on what the first 10 minutes of class were like. What happened? And I made sure I chose four students who had decent enough handwriting. So when they turned them in to me, I read the first one. And I said to the class, does this sound accurate to you? And they all said, yeah, it does. And I read the second one. How about this? Does this sound accurate to you? Yeah, it does. Were they the same? No. Did they agree on most everything, the big things? Yeah. And the same with the third and the fourth. They varied in detail, but agreed on the main matters. Very realistic. Had I stepped out of the room for a moment or two and came back in and collected them and found that they were using language and phrases that I don't normally hear them use, and all four of them are using them, I would think collusion, just like my brothers and I used to do when we got in trouble. We got our story straight before we went to our parents. We were all agreed. But strikingly, there seems to be little worry on the part of these gospel writers about how they might appear if they report the same event differently from one another. And not just in small things. Like, I think it might be John, I could be wrong in this, but one of them says, in the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus had them settle down where there was a lot of grass. Okay, little detail. The only one of them mentioned that. But in big things, important matters. In fact, the most important consequential thing, the details of the resurrection, differ so much. And we all know how important the resurrection is to the faith. Paul would say, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we are the biggest fools on the face of the earth, so we're hoping these guys get this information, their reportage right here. Consider this. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And the earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. Earthquakes and dead people coming out of their tombs alive seems very remarkable to me. Unforgettable to me. As if we'd be surprised. We should be surprised, I think, if not all four gospel writers mentioned that. But only Matthew mentions this unforgettable information. But that's, of course, not a contradiction that he's the only one. Each evangelist was not afraid to stand alone on what they saw, heard, and remembered concerning the most important historical event of all time. How many angels did Mary Magdalene see when she went to the grave on Easter Sunday morning? Matthew mentions one, John mentions two. If John's gospel was written later, which it's largely held to be so, it's highly likely, perhaps extremely probable, he was familiar with Matthew's account of the resurrection. You would think John would feel some incredible pressure to agree with Matthew concerning the number of angels he mentions on that Sunday morning. Yet he still mentions two, knowing Matthew had mentioned only one. Won't this compromise the veracity of their narrative? If there ever was a time to make sure we're getting these things straight, let's not open ourselves up for textual criticism unnecessarily here. But John sticks with what he saw, what he remembered, at the peril of weakening their collective testimony, at least in the eyes of some. Perhaps he's giving his readership the benefit of the doubt. Perhaps he thinks his readers are more intelligent and they won't jump to the conclusion that the mention of one angel by Matthew and two by him must absolutely be a contradiction. He's okay with it looking like an apparent contradiction. A real contradiction, of course, would be if Matthew said there was only one, or John would have said there was more than one, there were two. To mention only one when there are two present is not a contradiction. This occurs in at least two other places. You remember the demon-possessed man who was filled with a legion of evil spirits? And Jesus sends the demons into the swine who proceed to run off the cliff. Matthew tells us there were two such demon-possessed men that Jesus healed on that occasion, while Mark and Luke mention just the one. Matthew tells us Jesus healed another blind man at the same time that he healed Bartimaeus, while Mark and Luke only mention Bartimaeus. It's not a contradiction to mention only one, even if two are present. And oftentimes only the more prominent of the two are mentioned in such instances, perhaps because they're the primary spokesman. But here's what I want you to think about. Consider the self-control each evangelist had to write down either what they saw, heard, remembered, or what they thought was most important, what served their own unique purpose in reporting, instead of caving in to collusion. And so this too, their divergent account of the same event seems so much more realistic to me when you have four different people reporting on an event. Finally, their inclusion of counterproductive material. Their inclusion of counterproductive material. I had never thought of this line of thinking until I read Tim Keller's book, The Reason for God. Why include information in the Gospels about Jesus or the apostles or the Christian faith that either makes them look bad or doesn't engender a sympathetic following or that doesn't seem to further the cause of the church or support their mission? If Christianity is a mere human invention and these human inventors are trying to pass it off as truth, wouldn't they have deleted some of those teachings or sayings, actions that make either Jesus or the apostles harder to follow, or look bad, or weak? Again, I invite you, the next time that you're reading through the Gospels, ask the Lord to open your eyes to material that could seem to be counterproductive. I think you'd be surprised to see how much may appear. Let me just mention a couple examples. If I were a part of a team that were to decide what goes in the gospel, what are we going to leave out? I might choose to eliminate some of what's said by Jesus when he comes down from that Transfiguration mountain. If you remember, he comes down from Mount Transfiguration and a man comes up to him, pleads Jesus to heal his demon-possessed son, whom his other disciples could not do. And this is what we have Jesus saying to that man. We have Jesus saying, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me." He seems impatient here. I thought God was slow to anger. He seems to have come to his end. He seems to offend unnecessarily. And though he ends up healing the young man, he seems to do so begrudgingly. If I were one of these final editors, I would leave off the first two sentences. I wouldn't have it recorded, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?" I'd simply start by saying, "Bring him here to me." Or, in that statement about the Lord's work in his hometown, Nazareth, that verse that says, Jesus could not do many miracles there because of their unbelief. I'm going to tweak that word "could not" to "would not." Jesus would not do many miracles there because of their unbelief. But "could not"? He sounds impotent. I'm going to eliminate that or change that a little bit. Or we're supposed to believe in a triune God, a God living in harmony, doing all things with one mind, one heart, one soul. And so I might take off Jesus' saying on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?" We're supposed to believe in a triune God, and it sounds like not even two members of the Trinity are getting along right now. Why risk statements like these? Or the apostles. You thought about how much convincing proof they needed over those 3 years. Remember the scene in the upper room on Easter evening. 10 of the apostles are gathered and Jesus appears in his resurrected bodily form. Thomas wasn't there. When Thomas sees the other apostles next, they're completely unable to convince him that they saw the risen Lord. someone who's friendly to the cause, someone who's a part of the cause. And they can't persuade Thomas. This does not bode well. If it's going to be their testimony and God using them to convince others that they saw Christ alive again after his death, this does not bode well. How can they persuade outsiders if they can't persuade each other? I might leave that episode out, but this is one of those ones that Tim Keller brought to my attention. The very end of Matthew 28, verses 16 and 17. Jesus is gathering his disciples. He's going to give them the Great Commission. And we read this. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they, those 11 disciples, saw him, when they saw him, they worshiped him. But some doubted. Really? They've seen him at least twice, most of them. Maybe more than that. Some are still doubting their eyes. What I take encouragement from that is I think it's easy for modern day folk to look back on them and say, you know, these guys back then, they believed anything. They were gullible. Not so. Even though they saw as many miracles as they did, by definition, miracles are hard to believe. They're not gullible idiots. It's like they're saying, we're like you. We find this stuff hard to believe. Let me close with this. If the Gospels were man-made fabrication, written some 200 years later, when everyone they appeal to has been long dead, and therefore unable to falsify anything they say, they could have done so much more. They could have said so much more than they did to try to make this even more compelling. I think you and I can make a more compelling ending to the one that we're given pretty easily. For example, I wouldn't have Jesus first appear to Mary Magdalene. All four gospel writers have him appear to her first. Her testimony in that culture could not be counted in court as a woman. So I think I would start by having Jesus first appear to Pontius Pilate. I'm alive. And Pontius Pilate's wife, who had, remember those dreams about him? Unnerved her. And before I would go to the upper room, I would go to the Sanhedrin. And Jesus say to the council, look at my hands, look at my leg, look at my side. And then I would end the story by taking Caiaphas and Pilate to the upper room. And Jesus introducing these two men to the apostles and say, okay, let's get on the same page and let's spread the good news. Something like that. Either the evangelists missed a golden opportunity or they told us the truth and nothing but the truth. For these three reasons, my hope, my trust, my confidence in the Gospels grow because of their continual appeal to actual historical persons, places, and events, because of their divergent accounts of the same event, and because of their inclusion of counterproductive material. May God give us grace to believe the evidence that we've been given. Amen.